On Sunday, January 29, 1939, Luis W. Alvarez, a promising young physicist who worked closely with Ernest Lawrence, was sitting in a barber's chair reading the San Francisco Chronicle. Suddenly, he read a wire service story reporting that two German chemists, Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann, had successfully demonstrated that the uranium nucleus could be split into two or more parts. They had achieved fission by bombarding uranium, one of the heaviest of the elements, with neutrons. Stunned by this development, Alvarez stopped the barber in mid-snip and ran all the way to the radiation laboratory to spread the word. When he told Oppenheimer the news, his reply was, "That's impossible." Oppenheimer then went to the blackboard and proceeded to prove mathematically that fission couldn't happen. Someone must have made a mistake. But the next day, Alvarez successfully repeated the experiment in his laboratory. I invited Robert over to see the very small natural alpha particle pulses on our oscilloscope and the tall, spiking fission pulses 25 times larger. In less than 15 minutes, he not only agreed that the reaction was authentic, but also speculated that in the process, extra neutrons would boil off that could be used to split more uranium atoms and thereby generate power or make bombs. It was amazing to see how rapidly his mind worked. Writing his Caltech colleague Willie Fowler a few days later, Oppie remarked, "The U business is unbelievable. We first saw it in the papers, wired for more dope, and have had a lot of reports since. Many points are still unclear. Where are the short-lived high-energy betas one would expect? In how many ways does the U come apart? At random, or as one might guess, or only in certain ways? It is, I think, exciting, not in the rare way of positrons and mesotrons, but in a good, honest, practical way." Here was a significant discovery, and he could hardly contain his excitement. At the same time, he also saw its deadly implications. "So I think it is really not too improbable that a 10-centimeter cube of uranium deuteride, one should have something to slow the neutrons without capturing them, might very well blow itself to hell," he wrote his old friend George Uhlenbeck. Coincidentally, that same week, a 21-year-old graduate student named Joseph Weinberg found his way to room 219 in LeConte Hall and knocked on the door. Cocky and opinionated, Weinberg had been sent packing in mid-year by his physics professor at Wisconsin, Gregory Brett, who told him that Berkeley was one of the few places in the world where a person as crazy as you could be acceptable. He belonged with Oppenheimer, Brett had said, ignoring Weinberg's protests that Oppenheimer's papers in Physical Review were the only articles that he couldn't understand. "There was a tremendous hubbub behind the door," Weinberg recalled. "So I knocked very loudly, and after a moment somebody sprang out with a great puff of smoke and noise as the door opened and closed again." "What the hell do you want?" the man asked Weinberg. "I'm seeking Professor J. Robert Oppenheimer," young Weinberg said. "Well, you found him," replied Oppenheimer. Behind the door, Weinberg could hear excited men shouting and arguing. "What are you doing here?" Oppenheimer asked. He had just come from Wisconsin, Weinberg explained. "And what did you do there?" "I worked with Professor Gregory Brett," replied Weinberg. "That's a lie," snapped Oppenheimer. "That's your first lie." "Sir?" "You're here," explained Oppenheimer. "You worked away from Brett. You worked loose from Brett." "That would be a more accurate statement," conceded Weinberg. "Very well," Oppenheimer said. "Congratulations. Come in and join the madness." Oppenheimer introduced Weinberg to Ernest Lawrence, Linus Pauling, and several of Oppenheimer's graduate students, Hartland Snyder, Philip Morrison, and Sidney M. Dankoff. Weinberg was astonished to meet these luminaries of physics. "It was first names all around, which was ridiculous," he later recalled. Afterwards, Weinberg went out to lunch with Morrison and Dankoff, and while sitting at a table in the student union restaurant, the Heartland, they discussed the significance of a telegram from Niels Bohr about the discovery of fission. Someone got out a napkin and began sketching a bomb based on the notion of a chain reaction. "On the basis of the data," said Weinberg, "we designed a bomb." Phil Morrison did some preliminary calculations and came to the conclusion that it wouldn't work, that the chain reaction would fizzle before exploding. "You see," Weinberg recalled, "at that time we didn't know that the uranium could eventually be purified and isolated in much greater concentrations, which of course could lead to fission." Within a week, Morrison recalls walking into Oppie's office and seeing on the blackboard a drawing, a very bad and execrable drawing, of a bomb. The very next day, Oppenheimer sat down with Weinberg to define his course of study. "You think you're going to be a physicist?" Oppie teased him. "So, what have you done?" Flustered, Weinberg replied, "Do you mean lately?" Oppenheimer leaned back and roared with laughter. He didn't really expect a new graduate student to have done anything original, but Weinberg volunteered that he had worked on a theoretical problem, and when he explained it, Oppenheimer interrupted to say, "You have this written up, of course." Weinberg didn't, but he rashly promised to have a paper ready the next morning. "He looked at me," Weinberg recalled, "and said coldly, 'How about 8:30 a.m.?'" Trapped by his own cockiness, Weinberg spent the rest of the day and all night writing up that paper. He got it back from Oppenheimer a day later with one unpronounceable word scribbled across the flyleaf: "Snesigen Helolig." "I looked at him," Weinberg recalled, "and he said, 'Of course you know what that means.'" Weinberg knew the word was Dutch slang, but he could decipher only just enough of it to know that it was a favorable comment. Oppie grinned and explained that, roughly translated, it meant ducky. "But why Dutch?" Weinberg asked. "That I cannot tell you. I dare not tell you," replied Oppie. He then spun around and left the room, closing the door behind him. A moment later, however, the door cracked open. Oppenheimer poked his head in the room and said, "I really shouldn't tell you, but then maybe I owe it to you, because the paper reminded me of Paul Ehrenfest." Weinberg was stunned. He knew enough about Ehrenfest's reputation to grasp what Oppie was saying. That was the only compliment he ever paid me. He loved Ehrenfest, who had the knack of making things luminously clear and witty and pregnant in the simplest terms. That same week, Oppenheimer flattered Weinberg by having him present this paper in place of a previously scheduled seminar. But afterwards, as if to compensate for the flattery, Oppenheimer told him with a sneer that what he had presented was kid stuff. There was, he said, a grown-up way to do this kind of problem. And he suggested that Weinberg should get onto it right away. Weinberg duly spent the next 3 months laboring to produce an elaborate calculation. In the end, he had to report back that he could find no trace of the empirical relationship that he had predicted from his initial and very simple-minded argument. "Now you have learned a lesson," Oppenheimer told him. "Sometimes the elaborate, the learned method, the grown-up method is not as good as the simple and childishly naive method." Weinberg was a devoted disciple of Bohr's even prior to his arrival in Berkeley. Like many physicists, he found himself attracted to the discipline chiefly because it promised to open the door to fundamental philosophical insights. "I was interested in the fun of tampering with the laws of nature," Weinberg said. And indeed, when for a period he considered dropping physics, he only continued with it after a friend encouraged him to read Niels Bohr's classic work, Atomic Theory and the Description of Nature. "I read Bohr and I was reconciled with physics," Weinberg said. "It really reconverted me." In Bohr's hands, quantum theory became a joyous celebration of life. The day Weinberg arrived at Berkeley, he happened to mention to Phil Morrison that Bohr's book was one of the few volumes he had thought worth bringing along. Phil burst out laughing because at Berkeley, among those in Oppenheimer's tight-knit circle, Bohr's little book was considered the Bible. Weinberg happily realized that at Berkeley, Bohr was God and Oppie was his prophet.